阅读、科技、旅行，
生活可以很大，对话设计、学习，思考不嫌太多。这里是 iTunes 获奖播客《狗熊有话说》，一听就停不下来的哦。Hello， 大家好，欢迎来到独立知识型脱口秀《狗熊有话说》（Bear Talk）， 我是大狗熊。那么今天我们又有一位来自于地球另一端的嘉宾，一位专家和他带来的一本书，那么会在狗熊有话说这期节目里面呢和大家分享关于用户体验设计的一个专业领域的一些知识。 OK， Hello everyone， Here's another new episode of Bear Talk and I'm Bear. Today I have another guest from the other side of the worldand join us to share his story and insights about technology and also about user experience design. So I'm proudly introduce you Will Grant, the UX and UI expert from the other side of the world. Hello, Will.
Hey, hi Bear, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. I'm doing well.
So for the other guys, doesn't know much about Will, and the first I found Will's book a few weeks ago and finished reading it, which is quite inspiring and quite useful for my design improvement. This is a very good chance that the author himself could be talk and discuss with me about his own book. So it's quite a privilege for me. So and also for everyone here. And Will, could you introduce more about yourself? About who you are and.What you do and yeah, things like that.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Bear. So, thanks for saying such kind words about the book. It took me over a year to write the book and put it all together. So, it's just really nice that people are enjoying it and hearing some nice things back from people. So that's really great. So I do UX, which is user experience design.
Yep.
And I think my route into it was quite different to some people. I think a lot of people start with a more traditional design background and they move into doing UX for the web and mobile. But it's all I've ever done, really. I don't really have the more sort of artistic side of things. I'm not a particularly good illustrator, for example. I'm not that strong on the kind of art side of it. So my background's more to do with research and testing and trying to understand how people use computers.
Yep.
So I started out building websites in my parents' house, in my teenage bedroom, on a computer. So sort of 15, 16, building projects for people. It was always more about the way it worked to me. It was always more about, making it usable and making it fast and clear and simple and those kinds of things. Probably because I wasn't a very good visual designer, I guess. And then I ended up going to university and studying interaction design and usability and those kinds of things. But it wasn't really called UX then. It was called Human-Computer Interaction, or HCI.
Yeah.
So, HCI was the big thing at the time, and it only really became known as UX later on. And I just really fell in love with it then. I really liked the idea of thinking through how you build things and making them as simple as possible.
Yeah. So when did you just took this career? This must be a long time ago.
Yeah. So I think it's over 20 years ago now.
Wow.
Yeah, so I've been doing this sort of solidly for about 20 years. In jobs, you know, working for people and working for companies, but also on my own as a freelance person or a contractor, and also building some startups as well. Started a couple of different companies, and one went really well, and I think the other two went really badly. But that's kind of. That's how startups go, isn't it? You know, you learn a lot from things that go wrong, I guess.
Yeah, so 20 years ago, that must be over 1,000, 10,000 hours. So,
your 10,000 hours thing,
yeah.
I think that's really true. And I think there's something in that. You have just got to do things for a long time to get good at them.
Yeah. So, yeah. Chris, now... I found that UX design, it used to be a really rare world a few years ago. Like when I also, as a designer a few years ago, just involved about some interaction design. Like
you've dropped out there.
Oh, yeah. Is that clear now? Is that okay now?
I can hear you again now, yes.
Yeah,
carry on.
Okay. Okay, that's all right. So I found UX design is kind of like a hot word these days. Of course, it used to be quite hard to understand, hard to explain what I did a few years ago when I be involved in some app development, app design, about some user interface and also interaction design, and I found it's quite hard to explain to other people what I did for living as a designer. When I said I was a designer, they always think graphic designer or kind of like maybe a interior designer or something like that. But actually, it's about it's about digital, and it's now I realize it's more and more about human psychology and human behavior, so it's much deeper than just visual. So could you explain with some simple words to our audience, to the people who are listening, what is user experience design? How do you define it from an ordinary user's perspective?
Okay, so to define user experience is really hard, because I think it's changed a lot over the years, but I'll tell you what I think it is, and that's, so for example, when you walk up to a door in a shopping center or in an office, you look at that door and your brain makes a whole load of different judgments in a few hundred milliseconds. Your brain looks at the door, tries to work out whether there's a handle, whether you should pull it or push it, or whether it's an automatic door or those kinds of things. And somebody's had to design that. So somebody's had to design that door and work out how to make it usable. And if you apply those principles across to software, then and software products, that's kind of what user experience is. So when I open this product, when I open this app on my phone or this piece of desktop software, how do I understand how to use it? What's the mental model of actually using this product? But I guess it's broader than that. I mean, some people define it right through to the whole experience of using a company, for example. So in the example of an airline, it would be the app where you book your flight, but the user experience would also be queuing up for the plane and finding your seat and looking at the in-flight entertainment, all those things. So it can be quite a broad definition, and I don't think that's helpful sometimes. I mean, when I've been looking for roles, you know, either as a freelancer or a contractor, you do see a lot of UX roles, UX jobs advertised that are just not UX at all. You know, they're very much about aesthetic design or you know, front end development even sometimes. And yeah, it's become to be a very broad term that means a lot of things. And quite confusing sometimes.
I found it's really blurred the definition sometimes.
Yes.
And if you search some job descriptions about UX design, it's also sometimes just will feel this guy can do everything, you know.
Yeah.
can design a product from scratch and can talk to user, and so it's like I think it's need a longer time to kill the boundary from user research, user strategy, or visual design, UX visual design. So it's kind of like I don't know how to describe that. But it's also could be a good opportunity for someone would like to do something more involved with technology and the connection with technology and human.
I think you're right. I think it is changing, and I think it'd be good to like you say, it's kind of an opportunity for us as UX people to define what that is, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And I also found that you have a lot of experience on startup projects. Could you say something about that? Chris, I found you co-founded a mobile payments startup.
So this was, we had a lot of fun doing this. This was great. So this was about 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Apple Pay didn't exist or Android Pay. People, they had to swipe their card and sign a signature in a store to pay for something.
Mm-hmm.
And we built this product that let people pay with their phones.
Mm.
So you would add your card to this app on your phone, and you could go and use it in stores. And we had about 1,000 stores across London that you could use it in.
Wow.
We raised investment and we grew the team, and it was just a really crazy time, and we had a lot of fun and we had a lot of happy users. You know, we built a thing that people really liked to use.
Wow.
And I definitely learned a lot about user experience. It was good.
Hmm.
But ultimately it was just the wrong time, you know. The timing wasn't right, and we were put out of business, really. Yeah.
Too early.
So
yeah,
too early. Contactless cards came along, so in the UK you can pay by just tapping your card onto a little reader.
Mm-hmm.
That came along. Obviously Apple Pay and Android Pay came along, and those guys just, you know, they made our app irrelevant, really. There was just no need for our product anymore, and it was a shame. You know, we built something really good, and it kind of taught me that a lot of it's luck as well, you know. Mm. you need luck when you're building a company too, and
yeah,
we just got the timing wrong.
Mm. But you definitely learned a lot and some really valuable, you know, experience during the practical practical case, and also collect a lot of data about users' behavior or something like that.
Yeah, definitely.
Hmm.
Yeah, and did a lot of testing. You know, I love getting out and working with people. So user testing is one of my favorite things to do. So actually getting out into stores and watching people try to use our product, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's so much fun. I still do that today. I still do a lot of user testing out in the field with real people, because it's so valuable.
Mm, yeah. And also, Chris, it's probably another topic, but you mentioned a user's mental model before. Mm-hmm. A few minutes ago when we talk about general what is UX design, and I'm really curious about that, because as my background is more related to visual a few years ago, and when I started to learn UX, I found it's more related to humans, you know, psychology. And so could you explain more about something about a mental model?
Yeah, for sure. So a mental model is a picture inside your head that you have when you use a product. So you don't really consciously do this. It's something that just sort of happens inside your brain.
Mm-hmm.
A great example would be the way that messaging works on phones.
Mm.
So people understand that when you open a messaging app, like an email app or WhatsApp, you mm-hmm. have a series of conversations.
Yeah.
And inside those conversations are the messages between the two people. And it's a very simple model, but it just helps people understand how that system works. So for example, when you open WhatsApp, you wouldn't see a new message button. You wouldn't see a write a new message button because people would know that, well, at this stage of the product, it doesn't know who I want to talk to. It doesn't know what conversation I'm in. Mm-hmm. So naturally, when you tap a conversation and you go down into an actual chat,
mm-hmm.
then at the bottom of the view is that, you know, field to type in your message and hit send. And just little things like that, it sounds like a very simple example, but lots and lots of these little mental models get built by people in their minds, and they're essential for the way that we navigate our lives and our products. We have to sort of build these models, and a big mistake you can make as a UX person is assuming that people understand this model, because a lot of the time they don't, you know, they yeah. don't really understand the same things that we do, because we designed the product, right?
You, yeah.
People like you and me, we actually built the product, so of course we know it, but someone coming to it fresh might not understand that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's our job to kind of keep those models consistent, you know.
Yeah.
Don't put that messaging button in a weird place. Put it where it's consistent with the model, I guess.
Yeah, that's reminds me that at first when iPhone, the first generation of iPhone released about 10 years ago, so nobody know how to use a full glass touchable screen, and so at the first dial interface is related to our the real products, the real objects
yeah.
in our real world. So make
yeah.
connection with each other. Yeah. So make user easy to understand to get used to all the functions. So in this psychology. Jungles is like create a mental model
yeah.
in users' minds. Is that
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good example too,
mm.
Bear. I think you're right, and I think people just weren't used to a touchscreen phone. It was mind blowing at the time. So
yeah,
people had to have these little hints and these cues so they understood the model. Yeah, for sure. Mm.
So it's really it reminds me two questions. Reveals two questions. One is I found in your book, it seems you really don't like flat design. So yeah, you even use some extreme word like I hate flat design or something like that
yeah.
in the book.
Well,
so is that?
I mean.
Is that the reason?
I do really dislike it. I mean, I dislike it not from an aesthetic point of view, because I think it looks very clean. You know,
mm-hmm.
it does look very minimal and clean. And I think,
yeah.
Yeah, it looks nice, but it's just very hard for people to use. That's the problem. And,
yeah.
I think we've got to try and be objective as well. And think about other people. So we all work in the tech industry, right? So we're using products all the time. And I've done user testing with, you know, I don't mean this in a rude way, but normal people,
mm-hmm.
people who are not like us, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you do user testing with normal people, you'd be so surprised at how little they understand about again these mental models. And I'm looking at the Skype user interface while we do this interview, and
mm-hmm.
it's just really not clear what things can be clicked and what things can't be clicked. You know, it's full of these hidden, flat design creates all these hidden interactions, and somebody's somebody's mother or grandmother or someone who's, you know, maybe doesn't use computers much,
yeah,
they're just not going to understand where these buttons are or what they do. And, you know, I do think there's a balance. I think, you know, going the other way, as you just talked about with the original iPhone, it was crazy. It was too far in the other direction. But
yeah,
to make things so obscure and so hidden, it just feels like, you know, and I've watched people struggle with this. You know, I've watched countless people in user tests just staring at these flat design interfaces and just not understanding at all where anything is.
Those poor users.
yeah, I know, and I feel for them. I sort of feel like it's our job as UX people to try and give these people a hint.
It's also you know, when I read you said you don't like flat design, at my first impulse is I think it's good, because it's very clear and simple to understand and easy for the workflow. I remembered as a app developing team, we used to struggle with pixel to pixel design a few years ago. But later, when iPhone have different resolutions, it became a nightmare for the design workflow. So everything need to be with multiple display. But then after the flat design, and everyone get used to it for a while, and then it's easier to design, it's making it faster. But after that, I just take my user's hat, and then and I think, yeah, that's probably could be a big problem for someone who doesn't use technology products frequently.
It could be
very hard for elders, for our grandmas. That's that could be a problem. And also, you know, like WeChat, like the most popular IM app in China, and also quite popular all over the world. So their first version, they have a very clear goal, is to allow everyone in China, no matter how old they are, they are capable to use voice to contact with each other. So, which I think could be, it could change the if we can change the perspective, it could be different. And I realized, yeah, probably flat design could be quite good for users like involved in technology, and also some. Early adapters, so it could be quite good for them, but it's not good for everyone.
Something you said then, Bear, I never even considered. That's really interesting about how it used to be hard to do the pixel perfect designs, and then Retina came out, and then all the different Android levels.
Yeah,
so flat design, yeah, it kind of solves that, doesn't it? I never considered that was the reason behind it.
Yeah,
interesting. Yes. That's really interesting.
And also, when you said you feel sorry about those people who cannot understand them, it's also found. Do you think maybe a very important quality for a designer is care about their user? It's like empathy.
Yeah.
So how important do you think is that? I used to think things about how beautiful it is, and so so sometimes just give up the speed or even the usability for that, but I found if you if you just think with from a user's perspective, probably take care of them and empathy could be much important than that. How do you think about that?
Yep. So I think empathy is the number one thing you need as a UX designer. For sure. And I think I really like the field of UX because I think anyone can get into it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very accessible career that people can move into if they're interested in doing that. And you know, you can learn a lot of the other skills, right? So mm-hmm. you can learn how to do wireframes, you can learn how to conduct user tests, those sorts of things. And I think the only kind of talent sort of innate that you need to have is empathy. You know, that's the most important thing, and being able to put yourself in the position of other people mm-hmm. Is vital. And often it's people in sort of strange situations as well, because you know, we've talked a lot in this chat so far about consumer software that's used by regular people, mm-hmm. but there's a whole world out there of business software and you know, really quite boring B2B business software that still has, you know, hundreds of millions of users and is often designed quite badly. And I think a lot of the work that I've done over the years, it's not very exciting, but it's mm-hmm. it's important work, and that's trying to make those bits of software easier for people to use. And I think you need to have empathy with their job. You know, they might be in a call center mm-hmm. processing car insurance claims, for example. And the software they have to use is sometimes pretty bad, and being able
to use it all day,
and they've got to use it all day, exactly. And you know, building some empathy with those people is vital, really, really vital to making those experiences better.
That's a very good point, because we are, as a designer, sometimes we're always thinking about commercial customers, but sometimes about business, it's another field. And it's also about humans, so about people are using it. This reminds me a lot. And speaking of empathy, another problem I found could be very hard to deal is how to balance, like as a designer, you like more people use your products, and maybe for the longer the better is, but also you would like to like them just to solve their problem, and then just they're happy and you are happy. But in the real world, you maybe want to the more people use your products, the longer the better. So how to balance this? It's like something good and something valuable, or something evil, or how to balance it? I find this is quite hard.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And so in any organization, like you say, there's going to be that tension between sort of sales and marketing people who want to keep people in the product as long as possible and sell them the most stuff, and then us guys who are champions of the user, and we're trying to say, well, let's make things easy for them, let's get them through the journey as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And I think two things about this. So the first thing I think is it's our job as UX people to be that voice of the user, mm-hmm. and make that argument inside the organization, because and we're not going to win every battle, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes marketing will get their way and there'll be a pop-up collecting their email address, you know. that'll happen. But we still need to be that voice, don't we? We still need to actually make that case and say, well, this is going to make users happier. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it's about that, sort of standing your ground and fighting that corner, and knowing that you're not always going to win, and that's fine, you know, as long as you try, that's the main thing. And then the point number two, I would say, is the sort of the evidence really is that products that get people through that journey faster do typically win, right? So if you look at search, Yahoo and AltaVista and those kind of search engines were huge. They were the global leaders, and their home pages were just caked full of just rubbish, you know, ads and news stories and clickbait. And then Google came along with one search box and relevant results, and yeah. Everyone switched to Google. MySpace became clogged up with ads and, you know, all kinds of crap. And then Facebook came along, which was just simple and uncluttered. And, you know, I feel like we forget these lessons. These companies get really big because they provide a better experience. And then over the years, that experience gets sort of eroded away, doesn't it? Instagram. So everyone loved Instagram when it came out because it was so simple. It was post a picture and see a feed of pictures. That was it. Yeah. And now we've got stories and filters and, you know, ads that appear in your timeline. It just becomes this big cluttered mess. So yeah. I don't know. People will vote with their feet, won't they, as they say, and they'll go to the next thing that isn't cluttered.
Yeah, that's right. It's for a long-term perspective, it's always the faster and take care of users will be the final winner, I think. Yeah.
I think so.
And you also mentioned to fight with marketing guy or yeah. So
yeah.
So how to work with other guys in the team, like how to work with marketing guy or managers or clients? Because you have some experience on some real projects. So how do you think how to work with other guys?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. I think I've spent a lot of time getting this wrong, I think. You know, I think I've learned a lot about this, because it's not just about you being a good designer, okay? It's you also have to be a good salesperson as well, and you have to convince people. And the main thing I've learned in this area is that you can't over-communicate with people. You know, you've got to keep telling people. It's sometimes the same thing, you know, multiple times to get people to kind of to buy into your idea. Because, you know, if you're trying to make a change inside an organization, you're trying to improve a product, there are going to be a lot of people who just want it kept the same way. And it's not good enough. You know, I used to think it was good enough to say, okay, here's a better design, I'm right, let's go and build it. But that doesn't really work. You know, you have to actually go and put the effort in to convince people. You've got to sit with marketing, sit with sales, sit with management, and actually demonstrate to them your thinking on why your solution is better. And I think a lot of designers don't get that. I think they don't understand that, you know, 50% of it is convincing people. 50% is being a designer, but the other 50% is trying to sell people that your idea is the right one to do. And yeah, I don't think I realized that for years. You know, it took me a long time to get to that point. And yeah, that's really important, because otherwise you're never going to get anything done. You know, you're going to hit roadblocks all the time.
That's quite. Also, I'm facing the same problem on communication. So I found it's much more important than I thought. As a designer, it's like you almost spend at least a half of your time and energy to talk or to make other people understand what you are trying to do. And yeah, communication is very important. And and it's also like English is not my native language, so it's a little bit harder than that. To talk in English to communicate with other people. So yeah, I'm trying to improve this at the same time.
Well,
so
I think your English is great, Bear. I think it must
thank you very much.
I mean, you'd be totally fine to be understandable in, you know, English speaking countries. Okay. How do you get on in New Zealand? Is it? I'm asking you a question now. What's it like working in New Zealand?
It's like a few years ago, my wife and I traveled to New Zealand and as a tourist. And then we found this place is quite attractive, and then my wife and I thought, is that possible that we just come to New Zealand and live and work here. And yeah, and a few, like 2 years, more than 2 years ago, we found there is a kind of visa set named Silver Firm Job Searching Visa, which could provide it to the people qualified and can search for skilled job. And at that time my job title was multimedia designer, which was in that list. And I said, why don't we just give it a try and just apply it, because it's quite hard to apply this kind of visa. But we were very lucky that we got one. And then we just said, let's be bold and let's just do it, okay? And
wow.
And then we moved here. I found it's harder than we thought after we moved to a new country, because it's totally everything's new, all the control and new city, new everything is new. So we have to learn all the things from the very beginning. And I was so lucky that I found a job soon after we arrived. And then my wife was pregnant at that time, and then we have our daughter born here in New Zealand. So
wow.
Yeah, it's like quite lucky. So now
congratulations, that sounds really fantastic.
Thank you.
So we're doing really well.
Settle down here. But still, I think after Christmas, I will trying to look for a UX related job here. Because because my company switched their strategy, so I'm more involved as a marketing role in my current position.
Yeah.
Which I think I could refocus on UX design, which is my passion belongs to. I'll keep looking for positions later. But it's also there's a big gap, nearly more than 2 years. I didn't do UX related job. So
sure.
It could be a little hard for that for me to find a new job here. And also as we speak about this, another question for me is that do you have any suggestion for someone who'd like to start a career in UX field? Not just for me, but I think maybe for some college student or someone want to switch his or her career to this field. Do you have any suggestion?
Yeah. I think switching to UX as a career I'm not gonna say it's easy, because I mean switching careers is never easy, but it's certainly doable. It's achievable, and I think. You really can learn a lot of the skills, and you can learn by doing. I think you can get a lot of experience actually doing this stuff. Mm. So you know, there's sort of a natural learning process that's built into design thinking anyway, which is talking to people, testing prototypes, iterating those prototypes, and I think just doing the work of a UX person will skill you up pretty quickly. I would also say that, you know, when I look at CVs, people are applying, you know, with their resume of a CV. I don't always care if the stuff is real projects, if you know what I mean. Like, if it's something they've done speculatively, right? So if they've said, oh, okay, I'm gonna redesign the HSBC banking app, and they've done a load of screens for it, they've done the methodology, they've done the, you know, the personas and the journeys, and they've done a good job of it, then it doesn't matter to me that they weren't paid to do that. You know, that's irrelevant. I think you can build a portfolio relatively quickly by doing speculative stuff. And also, like I said before, I think a lot of it is empathy. A lot of it is empathy and objectivity. It's those kinds of things. One last thing I would say is you have to use a lot of software. I think it sounds really obvious, but you know, you should be installing the latest iOS or installing the latest Android and getting the newest apps and going on product hunt, trying all these things, because you need to be exposed to what the trends are in product design and interface design. And you know, the more stuff you see, the more kind of gets absorbed into your brain, and that helps.
Yeah. And how do you think about the future of UX design? Because there are a lot of trendings, and in technology world, everything's changing so fast. So
yeah.
How do you think, maybe in 5 years or 10 years, what will it become? And so how do you think of that?
I think, I don't know really. So there's a few things that are happening, and I think the sort of fundamentals of UX will probably remain the same. So we're still going to have to make things simple or discoverable or possible. You know, we're still going to have to classify interactions and make them usable. But I think that the mediums that we do things through are going to change. I think augmented reality, VR, and chat things are going to get bigger and bigger, and they pose really interesting UX challenges. I would also say that it only has like a special name until it becomes mainstream. Like it's called augmented reality, right? But then what Snapchat do with filters that, you know, turn you into a dog or whatever, that is augmented reality, right? That already exists, and people have stopped calling it that. And I think AI will stop being called AI because it will just be normal. It'll be just part of the product. I think something like chatbots and the kind of voice interfaces, I think, are really interesting. So Alexa and Siri and whatever the other one is, Google Home, right? Those ones. They're a really interesting situation, because it used to be that if you wanted to order cat food or, you know, something for your home, you'd have to go to Google or go to Amazon, search for it, and decide which one, you know, use a visual interface. But but now you're saying, Alexa, order me cat food. And, you know, you don't see which cat food you're ordering. It just appears at your house.
That's right.
So, yeah, there are a lot of different new UX considerations there. But I think it will all shake out over time. I don't think there's anything that's going to be a huge shift. I think it'll be quite gradual. But it's still being used by humans, right? At the end of the day, it's still going to be an actual human using it. So those factors won't change.
Yeah, that's totally agreeing. Because I used to think user design or user experience design just as a visual part, like UI design. Then the great example you mentioned about Alexa or Google Home or Siri, it's also a good example of UX design, but not related to graphic, to visual. It's things like it's definitely a user experience, but it's not. We didn't see it. We don't see it. We just by speak and by listen. So it's it's totally a new field or a new kind of way, but it's fundamentally it's about people people meet technology. So these things could be not changed in a few years, I think. People's psychology is quite stable for thousands of years.
That's
quite good. Let's talk something about your book, because that's the very reason, that's the first reason why we start this conversation, and why when we connect to each other. So why did you read a book about UX principles? Because there are probably it's good to for you to start this topic.
Okay, so why did I write the book? I wrote the book because I realized that quite a lot of stuff had sort of got compiled in my brain into a big blob, and I didn't really know how to kind of unpick it all into sort of principles and lessons. And I realized that when I was designing stuff, I was following the same rules again and again. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just going through these principles, and you know, I googled around and looked on Amazon, and there didn't seem to be like an opinionated book. Mm-hmm. And I mean opinionated kind of in the software sense. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there is just a certain way of doing things, and these are just opinions, and they're principles that you could disagree with, but that's fine. But if you just want a shortcut to doing these things, then they're all there. And I think that was what I wanted to build, and what I wanted to write. And when you look at what's out there, there isn't really another book like that. You know, there are sort of classics like Steve Krug's Don't Make Me Think from a decade ago or whatever, and that's a great book. I wanted to build something in this kind of legacy of that, really. Mm-hmm. But actually turn it into defined principles, so you can just look up, you know, email input, how do we do that? Or pagination, how do we do that? And just look at what I think the best practice is for that. And so it's kind of a reference. It's more of a reference guide, I guess. Mm-hmm. You can read the whole thing all the way through, but I guess it's for dipping in and out of.
Yeah, that's when I read your book, I really found it's so practical, you know. It's so so good to adapt some of the principles immediately to your current projects. And because I've read some other book more about theory, like Don't Make Me Think or The Design of Everyday Things by Don Norman. Yeah. So those are great books to build the whole picture, the structure in your mind about what do we do about design. But when you really need something that you can take immediately, I think your book is quite practical. You know, it's quite very helpful. So, and how did you write it? How long it takes, and what kind of tools do you use, or steps? Did you do some user research or something like that?
Yeah, so I wrote it. It took me about a year to write. There was a bit of research. So I did talk to a lot of UX colleagues about the kind of book that they wanted, and there's obviously sort of UX kind of veterans, professionals who've been around for years, and then there's beginners and new entries to the sort of field, and I wanted one that would kind of help both. You know, if you're new, it's kind of a shortcut to, you know, a lot of trial and error that I've done over the years. You can kind of skip that and just go to the solution, which is quite good. But then also for more sort of seasoned professionals, it's kind of prompts you to rethink how you think about stuff. And you know, I'm sure lots of UX people wouldn't agree with everything in the book, and that's kind of part of the point, really. They can find it, you know, provocative and disagree with it, and that's fine. So yeah, there was research, and then writing it was very much like a software project, actually. You know, a big spreadsheet with candidate chapters in, and then they were all moved around like a board, like a Kanban board almost. And then I used Google Docs because it lets you you know, track changes and collaborate, and I had technical reviewers who helped me review the book for sort of technical accuracy and things. So there was quite a few people involved in the sort of production team side of it. And then a lot of illustration and artwork, and yeah, it took 12 months. I mean, obviously not full time. I still have other stuff. I have a young son who's 7 years old, so looking after my son was important, obviously. And working projects and, you know, doing jobs and stuff. But part time, it took me about 12 months to write. I'm really pleased with the result. You know, we got some spelling mistakes in there, but apart from that, we're good. The software that the publishers use seems to have some sort of glitches where it kind of drops random characters out, because I've been going back to the actual masters and checking, like, surely I didn't spell that word wrong, and then I go back and it's like, no, I spelled that right. So how did that happen? So that's been a bit frustrating, but you know, I think that's just that's software for you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very good example you mentioned about the business software or professional software we use, but it's also need to improve their user experience.
Well, because I always thought it was like a big Word document or a Google Doc, but it's not. It's more like a database.
That's right.
So that it generates all the PDF files, it generates the ebook and all those things, and some glitches in that software, and suddenly you've got a load of problems in your book, which is quite frustrating. Anyway.
So do you get some interesting or funny feedbacks from your readers or from some people?
I think it's got a bit of a selection bias to it, because I've heard really nice things, right? So lots of people have got back to me with really nice feedback and nice messages, and I've really, really been like cheered by it all. It's been great. But I guess people who don't like it probably don't want to write to me. So it's kind of, it self-selects, doesn't it? So you only get people who like the book writing to you, which is great. I like that. So there's a lady called Elizabeth Churchill, and she's chair of the American Computer Society, and she's VP of design for Google. So she's actually on the board at Google.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote some really nice words about the book, which I'm going to turn into an actual review, I think.
Wow.
I'm waiting for her to like sign off and say yeah, that's okay, but she wrote some really kind things about it, and it just means a lot to me that someone
you must be feeling so happy when you as an author when you read his her feedback.
Really, really fulfilling, definitely.
Speaking of books, do you have any recommendation on this field, on UX field, if someone would like to learn more about user experience, do you have any recommendation, like a book list? Yeah.
Obviously, my book, 101 UX Principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
available
definitely.
Now.
Yeah.
but yeah, I think Don Norman, you talked about him already, so Don Norman's book, Design of Everyday Things, is great, and Steve Krug book. I think those are all sort of classics, and Jakob Nielsen's got a load of essays on his website that are all fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But those are all kind of quite old school sort of theory books, and they're great. But I think if you go to sort of modern era, I think there is Inspired by Marty Kagan, which is
Inspired.
A really good product book. And then there's one called Hooked by Nir Eyal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about habit forming products, and it's not as sinister as you think. It's not necessarily saying we should build products that hook people and make them addicted. It's not saying that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really about the psychology of how that works.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot that designers can learn from that, while still being ethical. While still building good products. I think there's some really good stuff in that book. So I definitely have a look at those two. They're both good.
Wow, those are great books to read. So, I will add all the book description later in the show notes later in this.
Oh, podcast. Great.
Yeah. Thank you. And Chris, we already took more than nearly 1 hour. So it's quite a good chat, and I've really learned a lot, and I would like to say thank you again for your accepting my invitation here and share all your insights and what you think about UX design. I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast will feel very happy. We learn a lot, same as I, just from your insights. So
great,
thank you very much, Rio. And
thank you.
Yeah, one last question. If some people want to reach out to you, how could they find you?
I am on Twitter at WGX. So it's just three characters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my Twitter handle. So yeah, you can at me on Twitter, or DM me, and yeah, definitely, that'd be great. Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed chatting with you, and it's been great to talk to you, Bear. Thank you.
Yeah, me too. Hope we can talk something about UX design or something else later.
Yeah, again, I like that.
Yeah, yeah. And hope you have a great day here in Lisbon, right? You are in Lisbon.
Yeah, Lisbon.
Mm. Okay, thank you very much, Will.
Thanks, Bear. Take care of yourself.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Bye.
See you. Bye. 本期节目由高效阅读课程赞助播出。阅读没有用了，这是这个时代关于阅读的一个最大谎言。恰恰相反，在信息时代呢，阅读书籍的能力正变得前所未有的重要。那些领先的成功者们，不论是西方的杰弗里·贝索斯、马克·扎克伯格、埃伦·马斯克、沃伦·巴菲特、比尔·盖茨，还是国内的马云、王石等等行业领袖们，都是通过大量阅读书籍来获取有效知识和信息的学习者。在这个时代， Leaders are readers， 领导者都是阅读者。大狗熊我呢，在六年前隐约意识到了这个关于阅读的真相，并且投入了大量的时间和精力来锻炼自己的阅读能力和技巧，也陆续在节目里分享了很多具体的读书感受。但我发现啊，更值得分享的呢，是我这套独创的高效阅读方法。所以呢，我将自己的阅读经验和方法呢，历时几个月整理为这门高效阅读的精华专题课程。这门课程一共包含12节，每一节呢会针对性的讨论一个关于阅读的问题。学习完之后呢，你可以做到一年阅读100本优质的非虚构类书籍，并且培养起适合自己的阅读习惯与输出应用的技巧，成为学习上的超人。一年100本书，这个听起来好像很恐怖，但只要按照课程里所教授的方法一步一步去做，是完全可以做到的。大狗熊我在6月到8月这三个月里呢，同时在制作课程，也在上班工作，然后还要带小孩，然后还要做播客的节目等等，每天只有很有限的阅读的时间。但即便这样，三个月的时间呢，也阅读了30多本书。所以这套方法有难度也有挑战，你想轻松速成的话就请走开，但一旦掌握的话，它将随着时间的增加而变得越来越熟练。越早学会高效阅读呢，你就越早能从阅读中收益。马上登录高效阅读的官网 readwithbear.com， read R-E-A-D with W-I-T-H bear B-E-A-R.com， 或者呢关注微信公众号狗熊有话说，可以查看详情。每张课程的第一节呢都可以免费的观看。狗熊有话说的听友都有5元的优惠券赠送。在狗熊有话说这个公众号啊，这个公众号里面呢回复高效阅读就可以领取优惠券。高效阅读，想学习想提升想成长的你值得来加入。